It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk about why blood donations are way down this summer and the nation's looming blood shortage.
First, we take a look at the state of international peace and the economic impact it can have. According to a new report from the Institute for Economics and Peace, the number of wars around the world is declining, but at the same time, the world has become less peaceful.
The Institute was able to put a price tag on all that violence and found that in the last year, it cost the global economy about $1,300 per person last year. That adds up to nearly $10 trillion overall. All of this raises some interesting questions. How can both the amount of wars and the amount of peace be decreasing at the same time is one of them. And how do we measure the cost of peace, which isn't quite as concrete as measuring the cost of war?
Joining us now to talk about these questions is Talia Haggerty. She's a peace economics consultant, and she writes about peace economics on her blog, Theory of Change. She joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Talia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how do we measure international peace?
Well, there are two different kinds of peace, and so there are two different ways to measure peace. I'll tell you about the two methodologies that the Institute for Economics and Peace uses, and we'll keep in mind that these are kinds of new things, so we might still come up with even better ways to measure peace. But the first kind of peace that's important is called negative peace, and that's just the absence of violence. We also have something called positive peace, which recognizes the idea that at some point we might put our guns down, but that doesn't mean that the reason we were fighting has gone away. Positive peace represents a state in which we don't need to turn to violence to solve our problems. So the Institute for Economics and Peace, who I've done some work with, they publish something every year called the Global Peace Index, which is an econometric index that uses 22 indicators to measure the absence of violence, or what we call negative peace. Then they have another tool called the Pillars of Peace, which measure the different kinds of social structures and institutions and good things about our society that coincide with the absence of violence and make up this idea of positive peace.
And as we mentioned in the setup there, war, at least war between different nations, seems to be on the way down. I think you used the phrase 20th century problem, international warfare. Where are we seeing an increase in violence around the world?
Yeah, that's correct. So what we typically define as war in the academic world, in the peace economics community, is a pretty high level of fatalities, and it involves organized parties, one of which is a state, fighting against each other for stated goals. That kind of organized violence is on the decline. We're seeing fewer and fewer wars around the world, which is a great thing, and that means that the problem that plagued us in the 20th century, we've come closer to solving. But at the same time, we're also seeing a lot more of what I call decentralized breakdowns in peacefulness. Those are things like terrorism, like violence against women, like the drug wars, where, for example, in Mexico, there are at least seven different drug trafficking organizations fighting against each other, fighting against the self-defense forces that have come up in southern Mexico. And they're also fighting against the government of Mexico and sometimes the government of the United States. And so that's not an organized war like we typically think of war. That's more of a decentralized breakdown in peacefulness. And that's the kind of thing that's unfortunately on the rise right now.
And getting into the economics of peace for a bit, and we've heard over the years about the economics of war, not hard to think of industries that might benefit from supplying munitions, uniforms, instruments of war, that sort of thing. But are we able to measure the economic benefits of peace and what we lose in the economy from violence?
Yeah, we're getting closer to doing that. It's difficult because we have to understand peace, and peace is a really complex thing. There are a lot of different parts of it, and we still don't always know what leads a society to use violence or not to use violence. But one of the methodologies that I worked on with the Institute for Economics and Peace is something called violence containment. And violence containment refers to all of our economic activity that goes toward creating, as well as addressing and defending ourselves from violence. And so IEP's most recent work estimates that the multiplier effect of violence containment, of reallocating our violence containment spending, would be about 2 to 1. So, for example, when we're spending nearly $10 trillion in the global economy, or about 11% of our global economic activity, on either making violence or containing violence, we really could be getting $20 trillion in a peace dividend if we were to reallocate that spending. So we have determined that the myth that war is good for the economy, that's been pretty well debunked. And we actually know that we're missing out on a lot of economic growth whenever we devote financial resources toward violence.
Well, thinking about investment in a place, whether you're talking about a high-crime urban neighborhood here in the United States, or opening a business in Syria, or in a drug war zone in Mexico, that's obviously a huge disincentive for anybody, an outside corporation or locals, to want to start building infrastructure, putting money into a business, doing things that plan for the future with such an uncertain state of affairs.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And we know that a sound business environment is one of the correlates of positive peace. So we know that where there's a sound business environment and also an equitable distribution of resources, high levels of human capital, so that refers to education and healthcare and these things, that we have much less violence and much more robust structures to build and maintain peace. And so one thing that I'm hoping the field of peace economics is going to figure out very soon is how, for example, businesses can go into those kinds of places and make an investment that reduces violence and creates an economic return, so that we can be simultaneously building that business environment and making it a safer place to do business.
And nailing down that point some more, that you mentioned, you used the phrase positive peace there. Peace isn't, as you said earlier, just the absence of war. It isn't just a ceasefire. How important is it to try to make those longer-term structures that preserve peace, as opposed to just stopping the shooting or whatever the violence is for the time being?
It's extremely important. Statistically, when a violent conflict ends in a ceasefire or a negotiated settlement, as opposed to one side of the conflict clearly winning, when it ends in a ceasefire or a peace agreement, the likelihood of returning to violence within 5 years' time is very, very high. And so what that tells us is that creating that state of negative peace, just putting down our guns, really isn't enough, because people are still not satisfied.
And looking at the rise in non-international war, so the conflicts, a civil war, drug wars within a country, all those things you mentioned earlier, those, as you mentioned, are on the rise. Is this random happenstance, or a bunch of places coincidentally going through a hard time now? Or is there some underlying factor that we can point to that makes these things happen on different parts of the globe?
Well, the value of the positive peace and the pillars of peace framework is that we're starting to understand what those structures are. So, no, I don't think that violence is random. I think that violence is usually corresponding to a pattern we just haven't figured out yet. But we are starting to understand the structures that make those things more likely to occur. And that brings us back to the importance of long-term investments in peace building, and not just relying on convincing people to put down their guns for the moment. So, for example, the relationship between economic growth and income and violence has been hotly debated in the field. But what we're starting to learn is that overall, when the opportunity to do business is constrained, when resources are not distributed equitably throughout society, and when there is a lack in information, in the free flow of information, when people cannot get connected to the internet, when journalists can't do their jobs, we see that these kinds of internal conflicts are much more likely to take place.
We're talking with Talia Haggerty about the economics of international peace and how much peacelessness can cost us all over the world. We're talking with peace economics consultant Talia Haggerty about the cost that peacelessness, violence, is having on the global economy, what can be done about it, and this fairly new field of peace economics. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see a peace-driven economic approach in the United States, around the world? What do you think that would look like? What would have to change? What challenges stand in the way as you see it? 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page. Talia, it seems like this is a pretty new field. You're kind of blazing a lot of new trails here, figuring out the vocabulary and the basic research at this point.
You could say that, definitely. I, of course, am standing on the shoulders of giants. There are some very, very smart people who started working on this long before I did. But the idea of referring to yourself as a peace economist is pretty new. Economists have studied war and conflict for a long time, and recently the field of peace studies has influenced us to see that if we study war and conflict, we'll know a lot about how to have war and conflict. And so we need to start studying peace if we want to know how to build peace.
And I, you know, we're on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, and I there were some who thought before then such a war wouldn't break out because of all the international ties of commerce between countries. Maybe they had it backwards. They put the economics first and the peace second. Should we be looking at the conditions for peace first and then figuring out the economic fruits of that as the secondary part?
Well, it is a cycle. So I don't think we can always talk about what to do first and what to do second, but we can talk about how we are allocating our existing resources and if we're spending a lot of money on. So, for example, we have this current situation with these young people coming to our country from Central America asking for help, and President Obama has requested $3.5 billion from Congress to deal with the situation on our border. Apparently, he intends to spend $40 million of those dollars on drones on the border. So I talked earlier about the potential multiplier effect of violence containment spending. The multiplier effect is an economic idea that when we spend $1, we get more than $1 in economic activity. And the interesting thing about violence containment spending, things like drones, things like weapons systems, even things like security cameras, is that those are unproductive investments. So when we make security cameras, those cameras aren't really used to make anything else, and we are robbing ourselves of some of that multiplier effect. So when we spend $40 million on drones on the border, we're missing out on a second $40 million of a multiplier effect that we could get if we were making more productive investments, like in education, in other structures that are going to have a payoff for a long, long time into the future. And so spending money on border security, militarizing our borders, might be not only wasted economic resources in terms of the multiplier effect, but that might also not reduce the amount of violence we have to contend with in the future. And so that could be very counterproductive.
Go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Peter is on the line in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm thinking about the way that different people from different parts of the world look at things very differently, and they have conflicting goals. And if we just look at things as if everybody has the same perspective, we may not achieve peace.
All right, Peter, thanks for the call. Talia, does this view sort of an overarching general look at the economic benefits of peace and some of the basics for a peaceful society overlook those complicated issues that arise, among other things, between people of different worldviews?
Well, we hope not, because I do want to stress that as a scholar of peace building, I don't think that changing the economy is the only answer. And so things like conflict resolution and mediation and conflict transformation and other practices that address maybe the religious tensions in a conflict or the social justice aspects. Those are really important and should certainly not be sidelined by economic considerations, because that's some part of how we've gotten into some of the messes we have to deal with today. But hopefully the field of economics, it's already very international. I work with a lot of folks across the world from many different countries and perspectives. And as a community of the peace economics community, hopefully we'll continue to integrate more and more voices into our work. So we will get peace economics perspectives from people who come from places where complicated internal conflicts are happening, and they can tell us how they look at the economy and what the economics of peace means for them.
So peace economics, you're not pushing it as a solution to all the conflicts of the world, but maybe something that incentivizes people who are trying to solve these problems to put more money into the peace side of the equation than the war side of the equation, it sounds like.
Exactly. And we're trying to help people see that mathematically, peace is profitable. And it's also possible. We know we are using econometric methods to understand the way that peace and conflict manifest themselves. And for example, one of the really exciting findings of the last few years is that nonviolent social movements are twice as effective as violent social movements. That's a statistical finding, a quantitative finding that tells us that many of us believe that nonviolence doesn't work, that it's not competitive with violence. And actually, that's completely the opposite is true. Violent social movements have about a 1 in 4 chance of being successful, and nonviolent movements have about a 1 in 2 chance.
And do you hope that just having that research and making it more publicly available will inform activists of the future when they're choosing that path of violence or nonviolence?
Absolutely. We have put a lot of global dollars and mind power into figuring out how to win wars, but we have not put a comparable amount of energy and resources in figuring out how to build peace. And so, like you said, activists can choose their tactics and their strategies. And one of my personal goals is to make more information about nonviolent tactic and strategies available to folks who might be considering that choice in their own conflicts. And we also want, you know, there are a number of outlets that are springing up with this realization that peace is both possible and profitable. The Institute for Economics and Peace hopes that the Global Peace Index will inspire governments to action when we see, for example, that the United States is ranked 99 out of 162 in global peacefulness. That's not very impressive for a global power. We have some work to do. So that's one outlet. And then on a more micro token, Foreign Policy magazine on their website, they have a peace channel that talks about the technology of peace, how we go about making peace and what we're learning about peace all over the world. So there is a growing movement around this idea that peace is an option if we want it.
So, you know, in a way, it seems new and revolutionary. And in another way, it seems like, why haven't we been working at it this way for, I don't know, a century or even a couple millennia?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Turns out that peace is really hard to measure. And the reason that the Global Peace Index, for example, only includes 162 countries when there are approximately 200 around the world is because we don't have data for the kinds of things that we need to measure in every country in order to have comparable scores for peacefulness. So we're getting better at it because we have more data and more technology to put behind the effort.
Talia, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for being interested in talking about peace.
That's Talia Haggerty. She is a peace economics consultant. By the way, she writes about the topic of peace economics over at her blog. You can check it out. It's called The Theory of Change.